Hi, my name is Mark Cooperberg, and it's my pleasure to introduce David Wyman, who's this year's Phi Beta Kappa Visiting Scholar. So each year, Phi Beta Kappa Society designates 15, only 15 professors nationwide as visiting scholars. So we're very lucky this year to have David Wyman accept our offer to come here and talk to us tonight. Okay, so David Wyman, he received his BA from Brown University, his MA from Yale University, and his PhD from Stanford University. His first job as a professor was, Swarthmore College. After that, for reasons unknown, he went to Yale University. And from there, he ultimately went to Barnard College, where he is now, and where he is the Alina Wells Hirshhorn Professor of Economics. So David is an economic historian with wide interests. One of his interests is banking and the monetary system, and that's what this lecture will relate to. But he also has given a lecture or discussion at the Lang Center today on mass incarceration. He's also been interested in telecommunications, the economics and the economic history of telecommunications, and Southern economic history. As I said, in addition to this public lecture, David has spoken today at the Lang Center. He's visited one class today, he's going to visit another class tomorrow, and he will be having lunch, he'll be having lunch in the economics department seminar room tomorrow for students who are interested in economic history. So if any of you are interested in economic history, come by, have lunch with David, find out what economic historians do. So without further ado, it's my pleasure to introduce David Wyman.
Thanks, Mark, and especially thanks for the invitation. So by the way, Mark actually spread a rumor about me. It was true. When I was at Swarthmore, I tended to dress very well when I gave lectures, partly because I was a bit young at the time and I thought this would enhance my credibility with students. So this is my token dressing well now. And by the way, before I forget, I'm actually wired here. So I feel like I'm supposed to turn this thing on, which I do. Okay, so let me do that so I can be recorded for posterity's sake. So let me just say it is a thrill to be back at Swarthmore. Where's the video? Let's just press the full screen. Press video window to. There it is. I guess that's it. To be back at Swarthmore. I actually almost called Mark to tell him. I said, by the way, I'm a Phi Beta Kappa visiting scholar. And so you invite me and I will come, actually. But needless to say, I forgot to do that, but unfortunately Mark was on the ball and arranged to have me visit. I do view it as, actually an early, but nonetheless, very memorable stage in my career. And, tomorrow I will just say I'm having lunch with a former Swarthmore undergraduate who is now a PhD student. And I can tell you I have a large number of students who actually went on to get their PhDs and still in close contact with them. So today I'm going to talk about, as Mark said, element of U.S. monetary banking history. So it's a combination of economics and history. So what he erased by putting the Phi Beta Kappa Visiting Scholar here is the fact that I also am a member of the Columbia University History Department, and I actually teach graduate courses in economic history to history students. So you'll see this kind of mixture of economics and history in this lecture. So when I discovered I was going to be a visiting scholar, and to be honest, again, it was completely by shock. So many have asked me, how did you actually get this? And I just said, I received a letter in the mail, which I thought was from the chapter, my Brown chapter, Phi Beta Kappa, asking me for money. And to be honest, what I normally do with these letters is rip them up without even opening them. I happen to notice, though, that this was actually from Washington, so clearly, unless Brown had moved to D.C. at the time, that there was something else here. So I had to figure out a topic that I thought would be of general interest. And needless to say, this is a prelude to this talk, the Hamilton soundtrack. You know, that was an obvious example, an obvious case of a talk or a topic that, that might actually attract a larger audience. So what we know about, and I'm going to speak about two rivalries, but primarily about one rivalry between Jackson and Hamilton. Needless to say, these are not historical rivalries per se, because obviously the individuals did not overlap. So one is this truly ahistorical rivalry about who's going to be on the money. And that's probably the one that's received most attention when the Secretary of the Treasury recently announced a redesign of the $10 bill and they were going to drop Alexander Hamilton from there. And there was a kind of groundswell of support, some, you know, actually even popular support for Hamilton. And of course, the only reason why there could be popular support for Hamilton at this stage is precisely because a lot of people had seen the musical and decided that Hamilton should stay on the dollar bill. And of course, Jackson, you know, has a somewhat checkered history, and there are all sorts of good reasons for dropping him, his face, from a prominent position on our money. So, I mean, I don't trivialize this matter. I mean, money and monetary symbols are important. Actually, one of the significant benefits of having your own money is to have your own symbols. And I was actually curious about this question, because the Eurozone, right, in Europe, right, European countries have dispensed with their own money. But some European friend informed me, of course, if you turn over the back face of every European currency, each country can still put on its national symbols, again, given the significance of that. So I just wanted to illustrate this briefly. So if you look at sort of going way, way back in American history, and this is part of a gee whiz, I bet you didn't know this. So colonial governments were actually issuing their own currencies throughout the 18th century. And so I will say this was actually a product for the students here. This is actually my son's term paper for an American history class. And what he was writing about was the significance of the rattlesnake in the colonial history of the United States. And so I thought, well, that's interesting. And I said, well, did the rattlesnake show up on the currency? If that was so symbolically important as a sign of the American rebellion, but also the revolution against the established British order, to have the rattlesnake lurking in the, you know, in the bushes, ready to strike, you know, did they kind of personify that in their money? And sure enough, they did. You can see this picture of the rattlesnake attacking the lion with obvious symbolism. But of course, once the United States became independent, the rattlesnake was clearly not an appropriate symbol for this new republic, and so we get the eagle. And so over this period, so roughly that was the point of this paper, sort of somewhere right in the early republic, this transformation. So today, the fact that we put, you know, we've changed the face literally of the $20 bill is really in keeping with the long-standing tradition of decorating your money with what are the most relevant current cultural symbols. But I'm going to deal with another rivalry, which I'll refer to as the historian's rivalry between Jackson and Hamilton. And okay, on this one, Jackson does come up short once again. So Hamilton is deemed by some, including a colleague of mine at NYU, as the architect of the modern American financial system. So I view this a little bit like an originalist argument about the Constitution, that the Constitution, you know, as it was written by the founders, that really established the American political order. And of course, we shouldn't actually deviate from that word. The notion that, you know, was it true that somehow this American monetary financial system was, you know, established at this one critical moment in American history? And from this perspective, Jackson is seen as really an anti-modern ideologue who basically demolished one of the critical linchpins of the Hamiltonian system. What was called the National Bank at the time, it's now, we tend to refer to it as the Bank of the United States. So if you've gone to sort of the Federal Center in Philadelphia, you'll know there is the extant building of the Second Bank of the United States, which is now a portrait gallery. The first bank was demolished itself. So he destroys the Second Bank, and he ushers in a period that many view as a period of monetary chaos. So what I'd like to suggest is that that at least in terms of the monetary history, maybe this critique of Jackson is a bit too harsh. So I kind of see the two as really representing, you know, polar positions in American political economic history. struggles over the centralization and decentralization of political economic power. So Hamilton is really, you can think of Hamilton, I do actually, as a quintessential mercantilist who sought to centralize political economic power at the center, that is in the federal government. Clearly, his part of his objective was to create a more perfect economic union, but in true mercantilist fashion, ultimately the goal was to create a more perfect, that is to say, integrated political union, and to see the economic union as the means to this political end. And of course, Jackson, especially as a Southerner and a Southern slaveholder, was a champion of states' rights, of local control. And this issue gets played out along a variety of dimensions. We're most familiar with the slavery debate, and that clearly is the most prominent instance of the struggle over central federal power versus states' rights. But it turns out, and this is actually really an enlightening discovery, I was reading what is a classic work in American banking history by Bray Hammond, and kind of a little regarded passage, he says, next to slavery, says banking policy was the most contentious issue of states' rights in the early republic. And I thought about that a lot, and I realized, in fact, that's exactly true. When Hamilton erects this sort of national bank, he's really seeking to centralize power to create, in fact, what I would call a monetary union, right, to sort of create a common currency region throughout the United States and to centralize monetary power at the federal level. And that is important not just for its economic benefits, but it conveys a great deal of sovereign power to the central government to have control over the reins of monetary policy. By contrast, consistent with the states' rights doctrine, Jackson sought to shift that locus of power to the states and to have states be able to conduct, in effect, their independent monetary policy. And I will say that my research actually all sort of shows up after this period I'm discussing right now. But if you went to the United States, if you were living in the United States in the 1840s or the 1850s, what you would discover is a country in which, you know, you would confront multiple currencies, thousands of different currencies issued by state, by banks chartered by state governments, all circulating as means of payment throughout the country. What's more, if you wanted to make a transaction between states, say from Philadelphia, maybe not to New York, but say Philadelphia to Virginia, you would see exchange rates, right? Not unlike the foreign exchange rates that we encounter when we travel abroad. Right? So these are actually, it's a very different environment, and it's only, by the way, in the Civil War that we start to see the consolidation of the American monetary union through, in this case, the formation of a common currency. And I'll have a little bit to talk about when we, at the very end, about the Civil War. And to say there's another unheralded figure in this entire narrative, and that is Salmon Chase. He was the Secretary of the Treasury under Lincoln, and was the architect of the currency union of the United States. So there are a bunch of lessons that I think are actually relevant to today, one actually particular to the Eurozone. If you look at the broad sweep of the history, the evolution of the American Monetary Union, and this uneven shift back and forth from central to decentralized organization, what you would conclude is that the American Monetary Union was not built in a day. That is, it was not just the brainchild of Alexander Hamilton or any set of individuals, but it evolved gradually and unevenly over more than a century. So if the Eurozone is suffering from problems today, we have to recognize that, to be honest, it's less than 20 years old. There are lots of growing pains. And, you know, in particular, and I'll say just to reference one of my own research projects on the 1907 banking panic, that panic was so severe that it turns out that localities were issuing their own currencies, right, in its aftermath. I mean, so, you know, we haven't actually, Europe hasn't devolved and dissolved the European Union to that form, but that certainly was, you know, what happened as the American Monetary Union was actually going through the throes of a very severe banking panic. Also, the tensions between the federal government and state and local governments, which are so prominent, to be honest, in the debates today, and so really do involve the question about where is the locus of sovereignty in the United States. Clearly, these are age-old questions that date back even before the formation of the United States as an independent country. So let me give you a brief outline. It's a bit of a complicated argument, and I apologize in advance. I've done it. I don't know whether it's effective as a PowerPoint presentation, which I would say is not really my specialty. I tend to just have a bunch of images when I present stuff like this to my class, and then I just talk through it. But I figured I would just give you a kind of sort of a guidepost of where I'm headed. So I want to look a little bit, I want to begin before the Revolution, the War of Independence, and the formation of the United States, and especially the adoption of the Constitution, to sort of see the background of all of these struggles in the conflict between the colonies and the crown over monetary policy. So again, this, you know, it's not the, you know, no taxation without representation, but it is actually one of the more contentious issues that arise during the Revolutionary Era period. And I mean, having the colonies trying to issue their own currencies, and especially states after independence during the Confederation period when fighting the War of Independence, this created a sufficient amount of monetary disruption that the founders felt it necessary to include in the Constitution very explicit clauses about who gets to control the money. Now, I will tell that constitutional background, the Constitution's incomplete in specifying the balance of power between states and the federal government over the control over money, and that's, you know, part of the issue that gets played out over this early Republic period. I'll talk a little bit about Hamilton's Mercantile's vision, and again, focus here on the so-called National Bank, or what I'll say is the first bank of the United States. And just to be clear, oftentimes I will use the acronym of the BUS, and how we tend to refer to it in economic history literature. But it was really seen as the linchpin of this monetary system. It was going to be the glue that was going to hold together all of the, you know, banks and, within the country to sort of form what we say is a more perfect union, meaning effectively a common currency that's regulated in some way by a central bank, a central bank-like institution, although the National Bank was really just a quasi-central bank. And then I'll talk about two critiques of the Hamiltonian program, the one that arises actually at the time by Jefferson and Madison. So I include this. It's not exactly relevant to the topic, to be perfectly honest, but it actually does, again, identify a long-standing strain of what is now a current policy question about the corporation. And the concerns about the corporation and its political power and its potentially corrupting influence of the American political economy actually it dates all the way back. Adam Smith was a kind of critic of corporations, but it gets picked up by Jefferson and Madison in response to Hamilton's proposal for the federal government to incorporate a national bank. So this is called anti-charterism at the time. And so this was the first, if you will, foray in the critique of the Hamiltonian system. Jefferson and Madison famously lose this debate, so the bank is chartered. And then Jackson comes along and declares war against the second bank of the United States and succeeds in, you know, basically dismantling that bank, ushering a period which we call, refer to as free banking in the U.S., and I'll explain what that means later on. And then eventually, by late 1850s, there is a movement to create a new national bank, or at least a new national currency, and that gets established in what we call the National Banking Act. So the NBA is not really, I'm not sort of heralding the beginning of the professional basketball season, but it's the National Banking Act. And so, again, you might be familiar with this. We've got, you know, PNB, Philadelphia National Bank. So the national bank that's part of the names of many banks throughout the country has its origins in 1863 with the passage of the National Currency Act. It gets amended a couple of times, and they're all bundled together to call this NBA. But the significance is that during the Civil War, under Republican rule, Republicans enact a kind of mercantilist program that's actually, in fact, more effective and more centralizing than anything Hamilton himself might have envisioned. And it does successfully establish a common currency. So the credit there, as I said, goes to Chase. Chase will be sort of immortalized in the Chase Bank, J.P. Morgan Chase now, although that was actually named in his honor. That was not a bank that he himself was either an owner or manager of. So let me begin with the revolutionary era constitutional background. So I just wanted to read the Constitution monetarily. Every time I teach U.S. economic history, I make sure that my students read the Constitution a little bit. So I guess in response to some, issue, I guess it was criticism that arose in this campaign. The question is, have you read the Constitution? At least I would say my students have read parts of it. They haven't read it in its entirety. And we're looking at Article 1, especially Section 8, which specifies the powers of the Congress, which include particular monetary concerns. The context for that are these colonial governments' experiments in monetary policy. They refer to as bills of credit. And I actually, again, am interested in this because they really do represent a significant exercise of local sovereignty in a period where the crown is trying to consolidate its hold over the colonies. And I want to look briefly at, did this colonial experiment in fiat paper money, did it work? And why do we care? And then one of its major defects, which the Constitution sought to resolve. So to start, the monetary clauses, in case you haven't read your Constitution recently, here we go. So the Congress shall have the power, and there are a whole slew of powers enumerated here. So one is to borrow money on the credit of the United States. I'm not going to talk about that directly, although I say it is actually important. The bank had a very important role to play in sort of managing the debt of the United States. But the one I'm most interested in is it has the power to coin money, regulate its value, foreign coins, and then, as an aside, fix the standard of weights and measures. I threw that in, by the way, because you can see fixing the standards of weights and measures, as far as the Congress was concerned, was pretty much the same thing as fixing the value of money. So this is really about national standard set. It's setting a national monetary standard, along with trying to figure out what it is a pound should, correspond to. So why did they do that? And the answer goes back to, one other thing, Article 1, Section 10. And here, the other explicit monetary clause is that states are prohibited from issuing bills of credit, which is this fiat paper currency. So that's about as much of a picture we get of guidance from the Constitution on monetary policy. So this is a picture of colonial currency. This comes out of the Massachusetts colony. You can see they were actually printing currency as early as 1690. And this is a 1741 version between the crown, before the crown cracks down on their particular monetary issues. And you'll see the impact of that. I mean, in today's terms, basically the crown sort of imposes something like a currency board, if you're familiar with that, on Massachusetts, but not on other colonies. So the idea here, and again, the reason why I think of these is so important in terms of their politics and the role of money in affecting political sovereignty, is that quite literally, these colonial governments are using their monetary issues as a means to exercise some control, political control, over their territory. And it comes up in a number of ways. For example, if they're fighting wars, and they need the funding to finance. Of course, the most basic element of sovereignty is obviously the sort of securing their borders. They would typically issue lots of money, right, as a way of paying soldiers or paying for their supplies. And then the way they would manage their monetary policy is they would tax their citizens, and they would gradually collect the money through taxation. And usually the currency will specify an exchange rate. And the exchange rate is the rate at which the government will actually accept the money in exchange for paying off their taxes. So in a sense, as long as there's a balance between issuing the money and then redeeming it through taxes, actually it turns out to be a very effective, stable monetary policy. And I want to show you an example, a very effective one. So I gave this talk in Virginia, and for whatever reason, we have data, very good data on New York and Pennsylvania. And so I used New York at that point. I guess that was a bit chauvinism on my part. So since I'm here in Pennsylvania, I thought I would bless you with a picture of, here's how your state managed its, fiat currency policies during a period from 1730 to 1774. And what I mean, this is a really very prudent monetary policy because, we would say it's a non-inflationary monetary policy because it's able to maintain a relatively fixed exchange rate between the colonial money and British pound sterling. So if you're looking at the So this is the exchange rate. You can see a relatively sort of stable exchange rate, somewhere around 165 Massachusetts pounds versus 100 pounds sterling. And notice that they're able to maintain this relative stability. So this deviation is sort of plus or minus 4% around the mean. So it's, again, you know, it's a pretty, relatively speaking, and looking at exchange rates actually throughout this period, we would say this is pretty comparable to what we observe in more developed markets. They've got, you know, fairly significant gyrations in money supply, but nonetheless, there is confidence in this currency that it will ultimately be redeemed at, you know, the par value set by the government. So that's a good case. That's a case of a very effective monetary policy. Here I'll show you a very bad case. This is actually Massachusetts. Here you've got, you know, a monetary inflation, inflationary monetary policy read over this axis. You can see the spike in the money supply and corresponding the sharp depreciation of the Massachusetts money vis-a-vis Great Britain. And so Great Britain clamps down on their monetary policy in 1751, which begins part of a revolutionary movement in the colony to try to reassert some monetary power. So again, this is, you know, they're using monetary authority in some cases prudently, in some cases not. But basically, this is all to sort of secure some kind of sovereign objective, whether it's fighting a war. For economists in the room, you'll say they're also, it seems to me they're using these as basically counter-cyclical monetary policy. So this is a kind of what we today call Keynesian monetary policy, well before Keynes ever wrote. And in some cases, they're using them as a vehicle for economic development, kind of issuing them through mortgage banks that are helping to fund territorial expansion. So the one problem in the mix, it turns out, is this the colony of Rhode Island. So if anyone here is from Rhode Island, I apologize. I guess we're not singling them out, but they have a notoriously sort of reckless monetary policy in which they tended to issue, you know, money, you know, kind of profusely. And the fortunate thing for them is it would seep over state boundaries. And this, so in effect, they were able to impose the cost of their inflationary monetary policy on other states, other colonies at the time. And this was clearly the matter that concerned the founders most greatly. And so that's why they clamped down on these bills of credit in the Constitution. So again, just to give you an idea of the problem that was created by all of these monetary profusion, this is just an example of exchange rates. You can't really read this, it's not entirely legible, but it just goes to show you that if you're a merchant that's operating in, say, New Jersey, between Philadelphia and New York, you are confronting a table of exchange rates like this, handling a whole slew of money and trying to figure out what exactly it is you're being paid in and what it's worth. All right, so anyway, that's the revolutionary system. And so with the Constitution, Hamilton kind of elaborates this program of financial banking development. So let me talk briefly about this. There are limits to the constitutional solution as specified in the monetary clauses. And so Hamilton actually erects a compromise. He creates what he'll call a mixed federal state public-private banking monetary system. So there are kind of a couple of dimensions here. There's the federal-state dimension, and then there's a public-private dimension as well. So the federal government specifies the fundamental value of money, or the monetary standard. So in economics terms, that's the unit of account. So the United States has, at least nominally, a common unit of account. But what it's silent about is actually who gets to issue the money. So today, we don't even think of a distinction between the unit of account and the money because they're kind of pegged literally one-to-one, $1 to $1. So, but it doesn't have to be that way. So here we have a unit of account that's set by the federal government, but then states are given a great deal of leeway in regulating local monetary supplies. And they do that by chartering banks and giving those banks the authority to issue currency that can circulate at least nominally dollar for dollar in exchange for gold or silver, the fundamental, you know, monetary units of the United States. Now, just because in principle the banks are supposed to redeem their currency at par dollar for dollar doesn't mean they actually do that. So Hamilton's solution to that problem was to create this national bank. And the national bank actually, at least fundamentally, its role was as the Treasury's bank. which means it's very large. It gets to branch across state lines in order to be able to manage the Treasury's transactions businesses. But as I say, in doing so, it's actually able, at least initially and then later on in the 1820s, to regulate the money issues coming out of all of these state banks, in effect, to try to establish a monetary union. And so there is, during these periods, a de facto common currency in the form of the currencies actually issued by the National Bank. So let me just talk briefly about the balance between the public money system and the private money system. So public money are just the gold coins and silver coins minted by the Treasury and that do circulate, but gold coins tend to be used in high-value transactions. So they really aren't a means of local payment. Silver do circulate, but that their circulation varies over time. So what I'm showing here, this is the percentage of specie, official money, to the total money supply in the United States from about 1820 to 1850. And so the bottom line is that throughout this period, the share varies from about 20% initially. It drops down. That gold and silver is only 5% of the total money stock by the early 1830s. It jumps up to about 30%, or about a third sometime in the 1840s and 50s. But the bottom line is that the vast majority of money circulating in the United States are these banknotes issued by state chartered banks. So we really have, for the most part, a private monetary system. And by the way, that is no different than today. I mean, most of our money takes the form, of bank deposits, which you think of as a private money, although more tightly regulated by either state governments or the federal government and the Federal Reserve. So here's the National Bank. By the way, this is sort of seen as at least a kind of a drawing representation of what the first bank looked like. By the way, when I was here, Kittori and I had talked about thinking of a project about banking architecture and sort of what is the image that banks are trying to convey, not just in terms of the imagery on their money, but also how they design their buildings. And I had just come from Stanford, so from California, and I was kind of struck. So you look at a bank like this, and it's clearly sort of sending a message. And then I recall, actually, there was a shopping center right near Stanford, and I noticed that there was a bank that was in a trailer home. And I thought, only under the FDIC could banks be located, in moving vehicles, actually. So you would have thought that would have been a kind of endeavor. So again, the key thing about the bank is its size. So it's got a capitalization of about $10 million from its onset. So that's in the early 1790s. The entire banking system at that time had a capitalization of about $5 million. So this is a huge bank relative to the size of the entire banking system. And of course, because of its size, it does convey that with that bank a great deal of power. And it also comes from the fact that the bank was able to branch across state lines. So you can see these are just locations of the bank's branches. Initially, they're concentrated along the coast, because their main job is to collect customs payments, tariff payments charged on imports to the U.S., and then to kind of circulate them around, especially back to D.C., for transactions by the federal government. Eventually, as the U.S. expands into the western regions, you'll start to see branches opening up there in important commercial centers. So the significance of all this, at least at this time, is given the bank size, given its ability to branch, it's at least able to create a common money. And this is just an example of a $50 national banknote, 1801. So this money would also be circulating alongside, the monies issued by state chartered banks. And at least it provided a kind of competitive currency that helped to stabilize the value of the local currencies issued by local banks. So during this period, the bank is not exercising a lot of overt power in regulating note issues, but by providing, all customers, with banknotes, starting at $5 denominations, which back in the day would have been still quite a large sum of money, in real terms, for most individuals. But nonetheless, for business transactions, it at least provides a secure currency that's immune from some of the risks of maybe using some of these local currencies. The one area where the bank's policy really mattered was actually helping to manage the debt. As I said, the bank was the vehicle by which the federal government paid off its debt service and redeemed all the debts from the Revolutionary War. And of course, that was actually controversial at the time because a lot of that debt, so this is just an example, a lot of that debt is being held in New York State and to some degree in Pennsylvania, regardless of which states or colonies actually incurred those debt obligations. So again, under Hamilton's policies, you start to see a centralization of the ownership of the national debt in the hands of, not surprisingly, New York financiers and Philadelphia financiers. And the National Bank is implicated in this policy of centralizing wealth, which in fact Hamilton's program does to a significant degree, because it is actually essentially stabilizing the value of the debt at the par that Hamilton actually set in the redemption program. So this policy, we'll go back, this incurs the wrath of Hamilton's opponents. They obviously opposed the centralization of debt issue, which they thought was a regional redistribution of wealth, which it was actually, from especially southern states, southern colony states, to northeastern financial centers. And it was financed essentially by tariff revenues, so it's really imposing that burden of redeeming the debt on the entire public, although, again, only some benefit. But what was more concerning to them was the fact that it granted what they thought was an extraordinary, that is, anti-constitutional exercise of power in creating a private for-profit corporation. And so they launched this attack against the bank on constitutional grounds. What's interesting here, again, is just as a side note, Hamilton writes, and I guess it's, I don't know whether it's true or apocryphal, that apparently in 2 days he writes this 125-page draft, delivers it to Washington. What's novel about it is that he develops the principle of implied powers, right, that we kind of know very well, which actually showed up in the Affordable Care Act, a Supreme Court decision about, again, the use of the Commerce Clause and the implied powers to at least adopt this health policy plan, which, by the way, John Roberts rejected. So what they argue is that the private corporation is akin to a private club. The private club concentrates wealth and power in the hands of its members. Oftentimes, it's able to then use that power to get public benefits, usually in the form of some kind of monopoly right, and thereby essentially aggrandize themselves at the public's expense. And they saw this as what they called systemic corruption. This is not necessarily any individual benefiting, but they sort of were really much more concerned that you were kind of sowing the seeds to undermine the political economy by creating these islands, this is, you know, to use a later term, islands of conscious power that would potentially have very powerful political influence over the direction of government policy. So there is this distinction between private corruption, for example, who benefited from the redistribution policy, from the redemption of the debt, you know, and there's a great deal of speculation and sort of private benefit. Hamilton, for example, sort of, it's pretty much his, you know, he's been cleared his name, that he never benefited at all from those programs, but the question is whether there was systemic corruption and that it created this alien element that was potentially corrosive to the American political economy. So Jackson, by the way, continues, you know, this anti-charterism tradition when he vetoes the rechartering bill of the Second Bank of the United States. So I kind of love the imagery because it really does kind of depict the anti-charterist view of the corporation, right, as this serpent, many-headed serpent. So this is the club of many members that ostensibly is combined to actually overthrow, in a sense, the authority of the federal government. And of course, there's Andrew with his sword. And let me just say, at the same time, the anti-chartist policy or ideology evolves from the Jefferson-Madison version to that of Jackson and Van Buren, his vice president. And at that point, they're not opposed to corporations per se, but they're opposed to corporations that have what are called special charters. So these are corporations that are legislated with special acts or special bills that provide effectively some kind of monopoly power to the corporation. And what they favor in its place is what we would think of today as a general incorporation law. So basically, anybody can form a corporation as long as they satisfy a set of, you know, sort of standard, you know, requirements. And I will say that the National Banking Act of Samuel Chase is exactly a version of a general incorporation law applied to banking. That particular policy originates in New York with its own banking reform in the 1840s. And you can see that essentially what the federal government does in the 1860s is to nationalize the New York banking reforms to get rid of, you know, any element of again, systemic corruption by eliminating the special incorporation. So we have Jackson's bank board. So again, now we have another national bank, the Second Bank of the United States. So this is the one you might be more familiar with. This is the actual building still, you know, in the Federal Center. This is Nicholas Biddle. I put him here because he was deemed the kind of aristocrat, right? So he has this very aristocratic kind of portrait that kind of reinforced that image. So it is, again, I sort of emphasize a quasi-public or central bank. And in this case, much more than the first bank in the United States, the second bank is really exercising a great deal of regulatory authority over the banking system. And it does so in ways that are trying to forge this monetary union in the United States, to try to rein in the monetary authorities' powers of state governments, and especially private banks chartered by these by state governments. Although I'll say it's not a fully bona fide central bank, it can't actually perform certain critical functions. But what it does do is it does really institute a common currency regime within the territory of the United States at the time. And that territory, you can see this is sort of the boundaries of the second bank. As I said, you're still covering the coasts because, again, its primary source of intake of federal funds is really through the tariffs, but especially moving west, you start to see the forming of the branch banks of the second bank in these commercial centers, but there are also locations, for example, of land sales. And so during this particular period of land expansion and the sales of the public domain by the federal government, another important influx of funds into the federal coffers via the Bank of the United States is actually through the public land market. So you've got this extensive branch network. And so not only it becomes a vehicle for being able to monitor and regulate the local banks, it also establishes essentially a network for moving funds efficiently throughout the country. And so in effect, the second bank, and I will say it's, I'm not critical of this. In fact, it's really performing a really vital role in this period. It's still a pretty, it's a fledgling country. Transportation is very crude at the time. So just to illustrate this, and I'm not even sure how these maps were constructed, but these are travel time maps of the United States, starting, this is 1800, 1830. So I like to point out Chicago here, actually Chicago probably was not even anything in 1800, but basically, except for maybe a military fort or just a trading outpost, 6 weeks to Chicago, right, from New York. Even by 1830, we're still talking about, you know, a three-week trip. So moving money around the country, it's actually even, say, 2 weeks to New Orleans, 3 to 4. I mean, so again, even on the coast, it still takes a lot of time. So a lot of travel time, a lot of risks in moving funds across space. And what the second bank does is it pretty much internalizes all of these flows by just adjusting ledger balances of the various branches, debiting and crediting sort of, you know, what each bank is taking in and which one's paying out to the various locations as a way of basically moving funds. That's exactly what the Federal Reserve is doing today as it moves funds around with the banking system. It just does so very efficiently through an electronic payment system. Whereas here, you know, it's all done on these ledger books located in Philadelphia, controlled by Nicholas Biddle. So in a way, what it does do is during a period where, you know, travel is very costly, very risky, moving funds especially, it really provides a mechanism, a kind of monetary infrastructure that really fuels economic expansion or helps to fuel during this period. And just another map showing this, the population densities. I'll just run through this. So the problem actually with the bank, I wanted to say one other point about the bank is that Biddle also adopts, there's nothing to illustrate this here, I guess there is actually, let me just jump forward a little bit. FITTLE actually adopts a relatively conservative monetary policy. So unfortunately, our evidence on the money supplies only go back to about 1820. This is a measure of money supply per capita, per population in the United States. So this is the BIDL period. And again, what you notice is that there's virtually no change in the per capita money supply during this period. But this is what we would say is a conservative monetary policy or accommodating monetary policy, which is fine as long as you're in a developed economy and all you want your banks to do is essentially fund the current production and trade activities of existing establishments. But that is not the United States of the 1820s and the 1830s. It is a rapidly, territorially expanding country, developing country, and so you actually need a corresponding, to be honest, a more expansionary monetary policy to accommodate that economic expansion. And so a combination of factors, but especially the tight rein over the money supply kept by the Second Bank of the United States, created a considerable amount of tension at the same time that, you know, the country is developing, especially in these new regions. And just to make the point very clear, it wasn't even just this monetary policy in the abstract. The central banking, that private banking institution in many of these frontier regions would have been a branch of the Second Bank of the United States. So in the Midwest, for example, what was called the Old Northwest of the time, about 80% of all loans in those regions were issued by the Second Bank of the United States. And in the southern equivalent, the Old Southwest, which would be Alabama somewhere to, say, Louisiana, the figure is about two-thirds. So basically, these regions are resisting this tight monetary policy that entrepreneurs that are trying to expand into these new territories, especially, and this is where this particular diagram shows up. So you start to see the formation of all sorts of cities. You've got the large cities like Columbus and Cincinnati, but you've got a lot of these smaller interior cities that are these points of trade and production. And banks are trying to establish, right, their own branches in these locations, but they're confronting, in effect, a monopoly that is restricting their entry. And so this builds up a political pressure that becomes the foundation of the Jacksonian coalition. And eventually Jackson is able to capitalize on that political conflict to issue his threat to veto this charter bill. He's reelected in the 1832 campaign, so he's sort of successful in this regard, and the bank dies. And notice what happens when the bank dies is that, whoa, the money supply really jumps up and increases quite significantly. So in this regard, you know, while the Hamilton's Bank actually performed a key role at a formative period in American political economic development, at some point it literally became a barrier to its economic expansion. And so Jackson's veto comes at exactly the appropriate moment to unleash what is really a kind of dramatic entrepreneurial expansion in frontier regions that leads, you know, fundamentally to the development of really the mining industrial center of the United States circa the 1860s and 1870s. And you can see this. This is just an index of economic activity in the United States. We don't have measures of GDP, for example, going all the way back here. But several scholars have tried to put together something called the Industrial Production Index. So during this period when, you know, tangible goods production really dominates the U.S. economy, it turns out to be a fairly good correlate to overall economic activity. So associated with the expansionary monetary policy of this new free banking system without the Second Bank of the United States, you see this acceleration of economic activity. So I don't want to insist that finance caused growth, but it certainly accommodated growth in this case. And what's more, and I just want to come back to this one point, what's really striking, and to underscore the point I want to make about the constraining impact of the Second Bank of the United States, what's striking about the expansion of the monetary system during this period is that it is fueled by equity, by the flow of capital from the Northeast to these frontier regions. And so that is really consistent with at least one argument that there were these significant profit potentials in these areas that were being repressed by the Second Bank of the United States. And so once the Second Bank is dashed, so you start to see this, again, dramatic growth of banks in these territories. And significantly, the red banks are what are called free banks that are chartered under this free banking general corporation law. So in this regard, if you look at the history from somewhere around, say, the 1810s to the 1840s, 1850s, in effect, you see that there is a virtue to the Hamiltonian policy of consolidation during a period of formative economic development, establishing this currency system that enables trade to develop in frontier territories without the risks and costs that might have been incurred because of the poor transportation system, the sort of impacted flows of information, and so forth. But by the late 1820s into the 1830s and 40s, right, these were really developing areas that had, you know, potentially thriving commercial centers and industrial locations, and that development was actually repressed by the Second Bank of the United States. So Jackson's veto actually shows up in a timely way to help, kind of, if you will, to help fuel or finance essentially this economic development. So in that sense, there's a case for both Hamilton and Jackson. And I guess this is, I'm not trying to be just, you know, judicious in this regard and try to give a little, you know, but the fact is, the reality is how I think of it. It's literally how I teach this in my classes, that there's a moment, there's a Hamiltonian moment and there's a Jacksonian moment. In this way, I kind of think of it as a kind of a dialectic of political economic development during this period between these kind of centralizing and decentralizing phases. But I will also say that Jackson's moment also runs its course, especially in the Midwest. So by the 1850s, and I think, again, I have another diagram. Yes, this. So by the 1850s, and this is actually, this is a railroad map showing you especially the new construction of railroads in the 1850s. By the 1850s, this region of the country is becoming increasingly knitted into a common trading zone. And in this circumstance, when you've got these large flows of trade between these regions, under these conditions, multiple currencies, multiple exchange rates become an increasing impediment to continued to economic activity. And this is exactly the conditions in which you would like to establish a common currency. And so, interestingly, it's exactly in these areas that are being more tightly integrated into this northern common trading, potentially monetary zone, these areas you start to see pressure for a national or common currency. And the irony here is this would have been the hotbed of Jacksonian democracy in the 1820s and early 1830s, and now you start to see a kind of Republican and Democrats becoming Republicans and championing a common currency, but they're doing so under rather novel terms. So by the way, my little map here. So here's our, again, Chicago case. And so from being, 6 weeks in 1800, this is now just a couple of days trip on a railroad by 1860. So the hero of this day actually turns out to be Sam Chase. So this is, by the way, a kind of a typical bill. This is the common currency issued by a national bank chartered under the 1863 National Currency Act. Notice, by the way, and this is actually one of these, I mean, discoveries I made actually, not in preparing this talk, but in preparing a lecture for my class. So I have been teaching this course, you know, ever since I was here at Swarthmore. So we're talking about from 1980, you know, up to about, you know, I think it was probably 2005, and I finally said, well, let me just show students a picture of these national bank notes. And I kept on teaching them, is they're identical, they're completely identical, right? Well, it turns out they're not identical, actually. So notice, by the way, this has got the name of the bank, Greene County National Bank of Carrollton, which happens to be in Illinois. And it also, these are the particular symbols that the Greene County National Bank wanted to embellish its currency. So it's just interesting, again, is sometimes it's useful just to look at the artifacts before you open your mouth and your lecture. But what's significant is it turns out that they're all economically the same. It doesn't really matter what they look like. They carry this national currency kind of emblem. And everyone knows that wherever they go in the country, this is going to be worth $5. And it does the job. So what's interesting about this particular measure for national currency is that there is no national bank still. But basically the law, what it does is it charters through the federal government national banks, each issuing this common currency under exactly the same general incorporation laws, establishing in effect money that's worth the same regardless of the location of the issuing bank. So this is a kind of ingenious compromise devised in part by Chase and a couple of, John Sherman, who is the brother of General Sherman, as well as a congressman coming from Massachusetts. And they devised this kind of ingenious system to combine elements of centralization and the common currency and decentralization of having local banks to forge this common currency system. So in that sense, I was kind of nominating Sam and Chase. I said, well, maybe Sam and Chase should be on a piece of currency. And so, thank God for Wikipedia. I just look at, denominations of American currency, and lo and behold, well, that is Sam and Chase. And that is the $10,000 bill. So we would all like to have a Sam and Chase bill in our pockets. Well, not in our pockets, but somewhere. It turns out, of course, that the Treasury has discontinued these large denomination notes. So if you do find one, it probably has a value that's probably way more than $10,000 at the moment. But to say that, perhaps we should be writing maybe a musical to celebrate Sam and Chase. Thank you very much.